From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. On today's show, it's Oscar fever in Hollywood, where writers are making up for time lost during the strike. And in San Diego, it looks like a Hollywood set, but a replica of an Iraqi village is teaching Marines some very real lessons.
So this first real firefight is no different than his last simulation. He's less likely to be emotionally disturbed or not follow procedures.
Those stories plus the premiere of an opera in Fresno inspired by a Native American healer.
There was something about her photo that just mesmerized me that I suddenly said, I have to sing her. How can I sing her?
I'm Scott Schaefer. Glad you could join us for the California Report. Sleep is not an option for crews getting ready for Sunday's Academy Awards ceremony in Hollywood. It'll be George Clooney versus Daniel Day-Lewis and Prada versus Gucci when marquee celebrities compete with plunging necklines for attention on the red carpet outside the Kodak Theater. Reporter Mary McNamara covers the inner workings of the entertainment industry for the LA Times. She says the run-up to this year's Oscar ceremony had the feel of a Hollywood plot.
There was real concern that we were going to have an Oscars show that was all clips, and I'm sure Gil Cates would have been able to pull off something that would have been mildly entertaining, but, you know, we all watch the Oscars because we want to see our favorite stars decked out walking down the red carpet, so I think everyone right now is so relieved that it's actually going to go on that it's only just in the past couple of days that everybody's been talking about the actual films.
One impact of this, the strike being resolved sort of at the last minute, is that they don't have a lot of time to prepare, to write the scripts and the jokes and all that. What impact might that have?
I think you're going to have, you know, a lot of references to the strike. I mean, fortunately, it's also an election year, and Jon Stewart is, you know, that's sort of his bread and butter. So maybe we'll be able to, you know, fill in with some political humor. So that should be interesting. Everybody, I think, is going to be quite giddy that they are actually able to pull it off, and they will be able to pull it off. I mean, because the people that are behind the Oscars, I mean, these are professionals who have done this show over and over again for 20 years, some of them, and they have been proceeding, you know, with plan A and plan B along their normal time frame. So it's not like they weren't building sets waiting to see if the strike was going to be resolved. They were proceeding as if it were going to be resolved. And so, you know, the people that are really under the gun are Stewart and his writers. And maybe if it's just as good, they won't start writing it month in advance way they usually do.
And I think one of the things that viewers like is when unexpected things happen there, that it's the ad libs that are so memorable. Do you think might there be a less scripted feel to it this year?
Absolutely. And I hope so, because I think that you're absolutely right about that. I mean, you know, one of the more famous moments was, you know, when Steve Martin was host and the walkie-talkie fell from the sky. And like, that was like the one thing that has ever technically gone wrong that viewers were aware of. And he made a little joke about it. Everybody loved it. And I think, you know, I hope they do capitalize on that, because what's amazing about the Oscars is that it's a 4-hour live television program. You know, we don't have those anymore because they're very difficult to do.
You, over the years, have had I would say extraordinary access to the Oscars. You've gotten to watch some of the pre-telecast rehearsals. You've been backstage at the broadcast itself. What are those rehearsals like, especially this year when there's, you know, so little time to prepare? What do you imagine is happening this week?
Probably, you know, everybody is, you know, a little more under the gun, but I'm, you know, they're doing what they do, which is they work their butts off. I mean, it's amazing. This week, you know, if those people see the light of day for 5 minutes, it's a miracle. I mean, they are in the Kodak 24 hours, 7 days leading up to the Oscars. And then on Oscar Sunday, they're there from, like, you know, very early in the morning. And then they go into that truck and they don't come out for 8 hours. I don't know how they do it.
I want to ask you about your book, Oscar Season, which takes place at a hotel called the Pinnacle Hotel, very much like the Four Seasons Hotel in Los Angeles, which you spent some time at a few years ago and wrote about what was happening Oscar week. What was it about the Four Seasons that inspired your interest was it in fact the inspiration for the book?
Well, when you cover Hollywood, especially during Oscar season, you spend a lot of time at the Four Seasons, you know, covering the parties or doing the interviews with nominees or potential nominees. I mean, basically, I was driving back and forth from downtown to the Four Seasons. And so I said to my editor, maybe this was like the year before I did the story. I said, next year, we should just go like sort of hang out at the Four Seasons and see what they do. Because, you know, one of the things we try to do every Oscar season is try to figure out a new way to cover an annual event. And also to try to, you know, show how the town is involved. I mean, everybody knows how the Academy is involved and how the movie stars are involved. But in Los Angeles, I mean, it really is as if we're, you know, a city's putting on a mini Olympics every year. I mean, you really do have like a whole economy that is based on the award season, and the fact that the Golden Globes did not take place, that was detrimental to a lot of people's businesses. I mean, there are industries that sort of are, you know, this is their big time to make money. Everybody from, you know, the limo services to the florists to the stylists to the customers to, you know, to the cabbies at the airport. You know, millions of dollars worth of jewelry is being dropped off there daily. Millions of dollars worth of dresses are coming in and out. You know, the day of the Oscars, the lobby is just wall-to-wall stylists, everybody, you know, to help everybody get ready to go to the show.
And then everybody collapses on Monday morning.
Well, no, actually, Monday morning is just as difficult because then you have people checking out and they have to, like, pack everybody up. And so you see on Monday and Tuesday, you know, some of the big banquet rooms will literally, they'll be like packing up the Oscars. They've, you know, or packing up, you know, all the gift bags that people have gotten. Bubble wrapping the Oscars. They have bubble wrapped the Oscars and sent them home for somebody, you know, because you can't take an Oscar on an airplane. Alert to anyone who wins this year. You do have to send it yourself.
Mary McNamara covers the entertainment industry for the LA Times. Her new novel is called Oscar Season. Mary, thanks a lot. We'll be watching along with you.
Oh, sure. Thank you for having me.
Two Marines from Camp Pendleton will be tried next month for their roles in the killings of 24 Iraqi civilians, including women and children. The incident made one thing clear: Marines need more training to make better life and death decisions in chaotic situations. Well, now, sophisticated special effects are being used at Camp Pendleton to prepare Marines for life on the streets of Baghdad. Allison St. John of KPBS has more.
In the hills at the north end of Camp Pendleton, an unexpected sound echoes around an old tomato warehouse, now known as the Infantry Immersion Training Center. The inside of the building looks like a Hollywood set of an Iraqi village. It's a maze of adobe courtyards, complete with washing on the line, dusty bushes, and rusty propane tanks. The simulation even recreates a certain smell, reminiscent of cow dung and burning fuel oil. A squad of Marines makes its way gingerly between the high walls and dark doorways. Robed figures appear and disappear around blind corners. An explosive device sets off a flurry of activity, and the Marines kick open doors and go house to house searching for insurgents. In one room, a video image projected on the walls simulates an Iraqi woman and a figure with a gun who turns to shoot.
The event that they're practicing in there is making instantaneously the correct moral, ethical, legal, and tactical decision.
Tom Biasini is the director of the Battle Simulation Center.
If they see a situation where a woman, a child, and an insurgent, what do? Take the shot, back away, take it another day? Certainly not harm all three.
The training scenarios are monitored from a control room where video cameras hidden in turrets and window bays record the Marines' reactions. Biasini says the facility is using the kind of sophisticated techniques used in aviation simulations for fighter pilots.
The infantry does 89% of the dying, and not nearly that much money is spent on infantry simulation. So this is the first attempt at creating what we're calling mixed media: pyrotechnics, live role players, and virtual targets.
The simulated training scenarios teach more than when to shoot and not to shoot. Part of the exercise is learning how to behave around Iraqi women and how to gather information from local Iraqi leaders. In a windowless room furnished with oriental rugs and low couches piled with cushions, an Iraqi actor plays a friendly sheik. The Marine Corps has recruited Arabic-speaking Iraqis to help them with the simulation training. The bearded sheik negotiates with the Marine squad leader through a translator.
The sheikh, he said, he got information. They crossed the border to Al-Qa'im and they come to our town, and he know one of the leaders, he need your help. to put him down. He knows where is the house.
That's exactly why we're here, sir. If we can get that information, we will go there.
And... he said if you have a map, he would like to show you the house on the map.
The Marines discover firsthand how difficult it is to find the right house, even if shown it on the map. To an untrained eye, all the adobe doorways look the same. The men make their way through the maze of courtyards, struggling to determine whether the robed figures they meet are innocent civilians or armed insurgents. The Marines search several suspects. After shouting the all clear to squad mates scattered around the building, they apprehend a man they find hiding behind a door. Turns out it's only too easy to miss the real insurgents and arrest the wrong people in the chaos and confusion of the darkened rooms, narrow passageways, and seemingly endless adjoining courtyards. Biosimi says it's all designed to prepare a Marine for those crucial moments when he must decide to kill or hold his fire.
So that his first real firefight is no different than his last simulation. So that when the Marine rifleman gets into a combat situation, he's seen, he's heard, he's smelled, and he's less likely to be emotionally disturbed or not follow procedures and do the correct thing.
Young Marines blink as they emerge back into the Southern California sunlight. They say the exercise gave them a taste of the chaotic and unfamiliar situations they'll face as they attempt to apply the rules of engagement correctly after they deploy. For the California Report, I'm Allison St. John in San Diego.
Even the best training isn't always enough to keep you out of harm's way. The death of L.A. police officer Randy Simmons earlier this month brought that home. Simmons was the first member of the department's elite SWAT unit to be killed in the line of duty. Simmons was a veteran member of the SWAT team, and he was considered one of the very best. He also spent time on the streets working as a minister, mentoring kids in some of the toughest housing projects in the city. Frank Stoltz of KPCC reports on what many are saying was truly a life well lived.
LAPD Lieutenant Michael Albanese says the first thing you noticed about Randy Simmons was his size. The former college football cornerback was over 6 feet tall, 200 plus pounds, and all muscle.
The physicality of the man was pretty imposing. He was just a man of steel.
Albanese, who commands the LAPD's elite SWAT unit, says Simmons was a reliable leader and organizer, a rock others looked to for support and guidance. The two-decade SWAT veteran also had a knack for talking with barricaded suspects.
Especially if there was suicidal ideations, Randy immediately connected with them, and it was heartfelt. And he was able to, you know, verbally walk them from crisis out to us. So there's a lot of folks over this 20-year period that are still living because of him.
Officer Guy Dobine partnered with Simmons, who prided himself on spotting felony suspects on the streets. Dobine recalls one stop that didn't result in an arrest.
I'm ready to get back in the car and go. And Randy's kind of hanging around talking to the guy. Randy's talking to the guy about the Lord and where's he going with his life, what's his next step. And this guy's a gang member. And then Randy puts his hand on, I think, on the guy's shoulder, and the guy bows his head, and Randy bows his head, and Randy prays for him.
SWAT Lieutenant Albanese remembers that Simmons would phone at the last minute sometimes, asking for time off.
He would go, I got 30 kids that have been promised to go to zoo, bike ride, skate park, whatever. Some people backed out. These kids are depending on someone to make it happen. You know, can I have the day off? And I would just laugh. I said, how can I say no to you? You always do this to me.
Some of those kids live in the Hacienda Heights housing project in Watts.
He always plays football.
He gave us money if we
want. Randy is a nice, kind guy.
Told us to don't grow up and be a game banger. He took us in the snow.
He always in our heart. He always going to be in our heart.
For 11 years, Simmons visited South L.A. housing projects as a minister with Glory Christian Fellowship International Church in Carson. He drove a converted van called Glory Kids, delivering toys and shoes and hope.
I'm 21 and my name is Rainisha Sims. He did a lot for me. He helped me get my life together. He taught us the Bible. Never, never, never was he on the negative. He was always on the positive. He always, you know, tell us, I can't. And it's always, if you need something, don't be afraid to ask.
Sim says she first met Simmons 10 years ago at the projects.
When I needed somebody to talk to when I was hurting, when I was down, I could talk to him, and he listened. And it really made me feel good to have a positive role model, male role model in my life when I didn't have one.
One thing that he had said over and over is, we have to help the babies. We have to help the babies. It was just an urgency with him.
Melissa Franklin works at Simmons Church.
He would mention just what he saw in the streets working as a SWAT officer. He would just see children hurting. Right now, I'm picturing him up there leading prayer, and he would be just bent over crying with passion.
LAPD Officer Dobine says that on the job, Simmons epitomized the level-headed SWAT man.
He just seemed so calm and so assured that everything was going to be okay, that I would think that nothing would ever happen to Randy, that he was protected. And also, he was a man of the Lord, and he was so devoted, I thought, nothing's ever going to happen to him, ever. If I'm with Randy, I'm protected too.
SWAT Lieutenant Albanese says Simmons harbored no illusions that he was bulletproof.
Randy would talk very matter-of-factly about the high-risk nature of the job. He said, it could happen to any of us tonight. I don't know how many times he said that. Emphatic about it.
Albanese describes Simmons as one of the most amazing officers and human beings he had ever met.
I'm telling you, he is the real deal. There are some folks that may believe that they are embellishing this because of how he died, but he was the real deal.
LAPD officer Randy Simmons leaves behind his wife and two children of his own. For the California Report, I'm Frank Stoltz in Los Angeles.
That bit of music is part of an opera unlike any you've heard before. It's not in Italian or German or even French. It's inspired by a Native American language that hasn't been spoken in decades. The production premieres this weekend in Fresno, and it's based on the oral history of Ascensión Solórzano de Cervantes, who lived with her Indian tribe near San Juan Bautista before she died more than 70 years ago. Now, an opera singer and a composer from Fresno State have teamed up to put her life to music. Central Valley Bureau Chief Sasha Coca has the story.
Joseph Mondragon was 8 years old when a man with an olive-green soldier's coat came to live in his family's basement in Monterey. The year was 1929.
Grandma told him that she knew he was coming. She felt it. She had a premonition that he was coming to open the gates for our people. Let the Caucasians know. They will know the Indian way, the history of our people, which nobody knew for a long time.
The man was John Peabody Harrington, a linguist from the Smithsonian who spent 4 decades gathering notes on native languages spoken from Alaska to South America. He'd come to record the oral history of Mondragon's dying grandmother, Ascensión Solórzano de Cervantes. She was the last fluent speaker of Mutsun, the language of the Amamutsun tribe that lived near California's central coast. Solórzano was a famous healer. People would come from all over California and Mexico to her home in Gilroy to try her rattlesnake weed tea and other herbal remedies.
My mother and her grandma, they'd go up in the hills and look for the herbs, and then they'd dry them in brown paper bag and hang them up in the basement. And then when they were finally dry, or just like making a tea, using that for fevers and stuff like that. And everything but fixing a broken leg.
Today, Mondragon is 86 years old, about a decade older than his grandmother was when she told her story to Harrington in Spanish. Now Mondragon's sharing his own memories with a different kind of translator.
Show as part of the backdrop for the concert.
Oh, I
see. It'll start out with her photo. And then these are the baskets.
Yeah, I see them, yeah.
And then this is hers that's in the Smithsonian.
Yeah, this is the one she made.
Helene Joseph Weil is a music professor at Fresno State. She's also a classically trained mezzo-soprano and opera director. She first learned about Ascensión Solórzano 20 years ago when she saw a picture of her in the San Francisco Chronicle.
I was so moved by it, and there was something about her photo that just mesmerized me that I suddenly said, I have to sing her. How can I sing her? Dios es mi grande.
Joseph Weil and composer Benjamin Boone have been working to put Ascensión Solórzano's oral history into a cantata called Ascensión.
When Harrington first arrived, he wrote down in his journal, as I came into the little room where Ascensión is lying, she said, Dios es muy grande. God is great. Thank God you came in time to save the language of our people.
And now it seems to me a curious thing that if the scientists desired so much to know the San Juan language, that they waited until all those that talked it best were dead and finished.
She trusted Harrington. As she said in one of her quotes, direct quotes to him, it's a curious thing that the Americans waited until all those that were dead and finished to find out about the tribes and their language, and then they just came and scribbled down any old thing. But she said, together, you and I are going to make that right.
To capture Ascensión's stories about the horror of Native American genocide, composer Benjamin Boone wrote this piece called Lamentation. Wide leaps in the choral parts create dramatic sounds that are almost discordant.
The Spanish are calling.
Of the trees, the caves of the hills, they're coming to seize our land.
The cantata has won the praise of some Native American scholars and historians, including UC Davis professor Martha Macri. She says setting Harrington's oral histories to opera is an innovative idea, and one that she thinks Helene Joseph Weil has handled respectfully.
It's not someone trying to imitate Native culture and pretend. She has really taken her great respect and regard for Ascensión and translated it into an art form that is her art form. It can seem quite incongruous, but in fact, she's presenting Ascensión's words and life to an audience that might otherwise not come across it.
Ascensión's great-great-grandson, Ed Ketchum, says her oral history is a kind of medicine to the some 600 people who are part of the Mutsun tribe today and who are struggling for federal recognition.
I believe it has the ability to serve as a healing process for our people and for them to have a better understanding of what took place in the past, and the fact that they have a heritage they should be proud of, and that they should honor those who passed.
For the song of Ascensión's death, Joseph Weil and Boone made the first recording of the bells of Mission San Juan Bautista and arranged them for a chorus. That's fitting since Ascensión was buried in the Mission Cemetery, home to some 4,000 Native American graves. The Ascensión Cantata premieres this Sunday in the Concert Hall at Fresno State. Future performances are planned in Davis and near Mission San Juan Bautista. For the California Report, I'm Sasha Coca in Fresno.
To check out photos of Ascension Solórzano and J.P. Harrington and to learn more about the Ascension Cantata, visit our website, californiareport.org. And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is the technical producer, with engineering help from Howard Gelman. Our online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are June Stinson, Ali Tabatabai, Harry Gregory, and Leanne Lucetta. We had production help this week from Nina Thorson. Victoria Malione is our producer. Ingrid Becker is the senior producer. Our news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California. The California Teachers Association, because every child deserves a chance to learn, and no child succeeds alone. More information is available at cta.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, a new website rating hospital quality in California at calhospitalcompare.org.